Welcome back to Mega Music Memories, the podcast that remembers and celebrates the music of our childhoods and the amazing artists and bands who helped to create it. My name is Matt Gibson. Join me on each episode as I interview pop stars from the 80s, 90s and noughties who, in my opinion, don't always get the plaudits they deserve for the magnificent music they helped to create and the magical memories we have today. So, if you're a nostalgia nerd like me, subscribe and stay tuned as we continue our journey through an amazing era of pop music. If you love pop, if you love nostalgia, and if you want to hear your favourite blasts from the past, reflecting on their careers and giving us the lowdown on what they're up to now, then you've come to the right place. So buckle up, friends, we've got some serious reminiscing to do. Thank you for listening to the second episode of my new podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed the debut episode of the show where I interviewed Nick Major from the noughties boy band Fix. But today's episode is all about the singer and actress Nikki French, who is best known for her global smash hit dance cover version of Total Eclipse of the Heart, which stormed into the top 5 of the UK and US singles charts back in 1995, and for fulfilling her lifelong dream of representing the United Kingdom at the Eurovision Song Contest in Stockholm in the year 2000. I want to say a huge thank you to Nikki, who was absolutely lovely and so generous with her time and her willingness to speak openly and honestly about all aspects of her incredible career. As you'll hear, Nikki shares some really vivid memories from the peak of her Total Eclipse of the Heart success in the mid-90s. And on Eurovision, as a former contestant and a lifelong fan, she offers some insight into what it was like to compete in the song contest, but also shares her thoughts on what makes a successful Eurovision track and how the UK might be able to improve on its recent performances. I apologise in advance that the sound quality at my end is not as crisp as I would like it to be. I was having some technical issues that meant I was unable to use my podcasting microphone, so we had to rely on my laptop's internal microphone instead. But you can hear what I'm saying, so hopefully you won't find it distracting. Now, I spoke to Nikki after she'd just got back home from London, where she'd been doing a photo shoot for the pantomime she'll be appearing in this year, which starts on the 10th of December. So I started the interview by asking her to tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, it was great fun. It's always good because you get to meet the people you're going to be working with. Yeah. I know a couple of them already, so that was lovely, you know, just sort of catching up with them. But they haven't been announced yet, so I can't say who. But it was great. And just trying on the outfit, trying on the wig, getting into character. And I know Red Entertainment, who are putting on the show, they were overjoyed. And they loved the fact that we all got on so well. They said it's going to be a fabulous team. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm so looking forward to being back to being a baddie again. Yay! I was all in sort of dark clothing and this dark wig, and it's piled on top of my head. So I said I look like Faith Dingle from Emmerdale, and it was great. I just, without the comedy, well, I will be doing it comedic anyway. That's how I do my baddie. But really, it was lovely to just sort of be in that zone.
Are you allowed to tell us what the panto is, or
No, it's Cinderella. We're down in beautiful Barnstaple. It's a place I've worked so many times now, and they've actually requested me back. I don't know what I've done, but they've actually asked for me to return. And originally, it was possibly going to be as fairy godmother. But then they had the idea of putting in Amanda Barry. And so she's now fairy godmother and I am now the baddie. So they're writing a part for me to be the evil stepmother. So the two ugly sisters will be my children. And it's just going to be fab. I can't wait. I love going to Barnstaple. Barnstaple, Chesterfield and Newark are three places that I've done panto before and just fallen in love with the places. They're lovely old market towns and, it's great. Lots of individual shops. And it's just a dream to be back there. I love Barnstaple.
When's it running from?
So we open on the 10th of December and we go through to New Year's Eve. We usually get one day off a week and we'll have Christmas Day off. And that's the day that I cook for everybody that can't get home to see their loved ones. I always invite anyone from the panto to come round to wherever I'm living. And thankfully, we're living in a gorgeous, gorgeous property, which I stayed in before, called the Dairy Cottage. So it's got a nice kitchen and it's got a fabulous dining room. So there'll be plenty of space for anyone that needs to come for their Christmas dinner.
So we'll come back to your acting and so on and what you're up to nowadays. But if I may now take you all the way back, right back to your childhood, really. In the last interview that I did here on Mega Music Memories, I spoke to Nick Major, who was in the noughties boy band Fix.
Oh, yes, yes.
That when he was a kid, he was glued to Top of the Pops as a young child from his, you know, early childhood. And he always wanted to be a singer. Was it the same sort of deal for you, Nikki?
Absolutely. When I was about, I think I must have been about 6 years old, and one of my godmothers had visited for a few days, and I was sat next to mum and dad's old sort of stereo system listening to, back then it was the top 20, we didn't have top 40, it was the top 20, and singing along to everything. And I always remember she turned around to mum and dad and said, she's going to be a singer when she grows up. And it just cemented it for me. So I joined my brother's band when I was 12 and it just sort of went on from there. So it was always in my brain to do singing, and no one ever laughed at me when I said it. So, you know, it's kind of people got the seriousness of it from me. And even at school, you know, we'd finish a gig that was a sort of 2 hour drive away on a Sunday night. And so I'd get in at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning on a Monday morning and then have to get up for school the next morning. So my mum always said to me, so long as it doesn't interfere with your schoolwork, you can carry on. Mm. As soon as it interferes, I'm going to tell you, you've got to stop. So because of that, I kind of had it. Sort of subconsciously, I knew that I had to work extra hard at both, really. And again, you know, sort of had a discipline about it, which, you know, I've carried through all my career, I'd like to think. So, I've always loved singing.
And it's paid off, I think, that discipline.
I'm so lucky to, I always say to people, I'm lucky to be able to do a job that I enjoy, that I relish. You know, so many people, they have a job that they just don't look forward to going into. I've had the office jobs and I loved doing them. I really did. I like being organized and set up, sort of thing. But, you know, singing was the one thing that I really, really wanted to do, and acting as well. I'm not the greatest actress in the world, but I know I'm a decent singer. And so, you know, combining the two was my ultimate dream. But, you know, I kind of got to the option of becoming a professional singer and went down that route. And I've loved pretty much every second of my career. And I still do love it. You know, I don't want to give up yet. I've been lucky enough to do a job that I enjoy.
Brilliant. Well, going back to the very beginning of that career, 1986, Nikki, Whiskey and Sofa. What's that all about?
So it was, and I, you know, I don't even remember how I got involved. Yes, it's a song called Dirty Den, written by Barry Mason, of all people, the man behind Delilah and what else did he write? Green, Green Grass of Home and, oh, so many amazing songs. And he wrote this basically sort of Mickey Take type song, tongue in cheek, about Dirty Den from EastEnders. And he had Jim Dale from the Carry On films. It was his son, Toby, who was the male on the song. And they got me in to sing the choruses, sort of in the mode of Wendy Richard. And just, yeah, it got played on Radio 1. And it was the weirdest experience of my life, I think. But it was fun. It was fun. And yes, it didn't set the world alight
I've been trying to get a hold of it, Nikki. I can't find it. Is it out there anywhere? Yeah,
the copies are probably all up in my loft and I won't let anyone hear it.
Fair enough. And you've sang on stage with Gazza as well, haven't you? Is that right?
I did. I have a photo down in my hallway, actually. I was, my then manager, Jim, he actually booked me for, because I'm a huge Tottenham fan. Yeah. And so he contacted the club one year and got me singing at their Player of the Season dinner dance. And which was won by Chrissy Waddle, I have to just add. But yes, they've just taken on this brand new player called Paul Gascoigne. And so there's a photo downstairs where I'm getting all the players up to join me on stage. And there's Gazza sort of pointing out all these different players to get up on stage. So yes, I kind of did some singing with Gazza. He didn't sing into the microphone. Frog on the Tyne was a few years away, but we did. Yes, he was standing next to me and I have the photos in a frame in my hallway. It's yeah, very proud moment.
Oh, brilliant. And Chris Waddle, of course, good singer as well, isn't he?
And I met him in 1995. I was booked for lots and lots of sort of Radio 1 road shows and Capital Radio road shows around the country. And we were doing one in, where was it? Somewhere like Stoke or something. And he was there backstage as well. And he asked me for a photo with him. Oh. So that's in my spare bedroom, actually. you're going around my photo booth. Yeah, that photo is on the window ledge in my spare bedroom, where we had a photo taken because I said to him, I'm a Tottenham fan. And he said, I love Total Eclipse of the Heart. Could I have a photo? So, oh, blessed beyond belief that he asked me.
Wow, yes, Spurs legends just peppered around your house.
Exactly.
So you were a session singer as well, is that right, before?
I do sessions, and that's all I ever wanted. Being a front woman was never really my plan. You know, I'm you know, with the best will in the world, I'm not glamorous and I'm not sort of like stagey. I used to love, and I still, my favourite thing is when I'm in the studio is to work on the backing vocals and the harmonies. Harmonies just come to me and I love working out backing vocals. The last couple of albums I've done, I am my backing vocalist and I spend 2 or 3 hours working on the backing vocals and then I do my lead vocal and it's like, got to do that now. But I enjoy all of it, but my favorite thing is working out some harmonies and backing vocals for people's songs, and I love that. And I'm lucky that with the record company I'm with, Energize, they book me quite often to go in and do other artists backing vocals for them as well. So, yeah, I'm very lucky in that aspect. I love it.
Wonderful. So, during this sort of period when you were sort of working, sort of doing the clubs and, you know, the session singing and so on and so forth, that's when you met a gentleman called John Springates, wasn't it?
Yes, in Cardiff. I was a regular at a pub club in Cardiff called the Red Dragon, which is now a Marks and Spencer's. and the two guys that ran it kept on saying to me, "You really need to meet John Springate. You two could work well together." And they kept saying the same to him. And it just so happened that one night I was working at the Dragon and he was working at another club around the corner later on. So I decided, okay, you know, we ought to meet. So we met up and a couple of weeks later I was working in his studio, working on some demo tracks. And many years later, he contacted me about doing a dance version of Total Eclipse of the Heart, which the Energize Records guys had asked him to find a singer for. So that all started again. And then 5 years after that, we were connected again with Eurovision. So John's been very influential in my career, bless him. And we still keep in touch now. He's a lovely guy and he now lives over in Wales. So it's kind of come full circle for him.
Yeah. And so when you were asked to do a dance cover of Total Eclipse of the Heart, what was your sort of initial reaction to that?
Initially, I just thought, no, you don't muck around with a classic like that. You know, I have Bonnie Tyler's single in my record collection. And I just thought, no, that's sacrilege. You cannot mess around with a song like that. But then he played me a little bit of it, of the backing track down the phone. And I thought, ooh, that might work, but it won't be right for my voice. It's far too ambitious for me to try and sing. And I tried to sing it and it just sat exactly where I needed it to in my vocal range. So I went over to his studio and recorded it. And we sold some 12-inch singles around clubs and so on. And then the Energize guys and John all knew this guy called Pitstop. His real name was Peter Thompson, who worked at PWL and Stock Aitken and Waterman Studios in previous years. And he was now working with Mike and Matt at their new venture, which was called Love This Records. So he took a copy to them and said, "What do you think?" And so they then decided, yeah, we can do something with this. So they made a more mainstream version. And even then I was invited in to meet the guys and I thought, oh, that's nice. They're going to thank me for doing all this and they're now going to get a proper singer on board. But no, they talked about, right, well, we'll keep the backing vocals as they are, which were John and I, John and me. And then they said, but we want you to re-record your lead vocal. So I did that. And yeah, it all just took off from there, really.
Yeah. And of course, that's Mike Stock and Matt Aitken of Stock Aitken and Waterman fame.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Hit Factory, huge guys, massively influential in the 80s. What was it like working with them? What was that like?
The first few days, it was just surreal. Yeah, totally surreal. I mean, these guys were absolute legends and icons. And I couldn't believe that, you know, this pub singer was working with these amazing icons and going in the studio and seeing all these gold records around. But it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. So much so that some years later, I worked with Mike again. But I really did. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I went through a slipped disc at the time and they couldn't have been more concerned and caring. You know, when I was going in, I was recording the first album and my then husband was driving me in I was laid on the back seat of the car. I saw a lot of London, actually. It's amazing what you see when you look up. And so we'd get to the studio, and all day, both Mike and Matt would say to me, if you need to sit down or lay down or do anything, just let us know. But it was great. They were very, you know, considerate, and gave me some wonderful songs from that first album. And I had a ball working with them. You felt this great buzz when you were working with these guys. You know, they loved being in the studio, writing their songs and then producing them. And as a singer, to be there working with them was just a joy, a joy.
Yeah, and when you first released Total Eclipse back in 1994, didn't go that well, did it? It didn't actually chart that high.
No, it was sort of 60 something, I think, in the charts. And I just thought, well, it was a great experience. That's marvellous. And I just thought, that's fine, and went back to working in the pubs and what have you. And then I got a phone call from Mike, about 8 weeks later, saying the buzz will not die down on this song. So we're going to redo the start and re-evaluate the song, and we're going to re-release it in January. And that was when it just went off the scale, just mad, totally mad. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was wonderful. And I loved every second of it. You know, in this industry, you have to be prepared to work really, 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 really hard. And anyone that doesn't, then they're just not going to get anywhere. I loved it. You know, I was up at the crack of dawn. I still am. I'm up at the crack of dawn, going to bed late, having 4 hours sleep or something. Just wonderful. I just loved it.
So it was re-recorded then, the intro. How many versions were there in the end of Total Eclipse?
Oh, gosh. Well, nowadays, I lost count.
I mean, your version, I mean. Obviously, I don't mean...
My version, I think there was the fast opening, yeah, radio edit, the slow opening radio edit. So the fast one was the blue single, and the slow intro was the yellow single, and that was the new one, and ended up outselling the blue one 4-1. Then there was the long 6-minute version, the club version, which is the one that I tend to do in the clubs and on gigs. So yeah, and probably two or three others. Nowadays there are just so many. And in fact, when the record company now say to me, oh, shall we do a new mix? I'm like, no, just leave it. There are more than enough versions of Total Eclipse of the Heart now by Nikki French. We do not need any more. So, there were at least three or four back then, that Mike and Matt worked on. But as I say, the slow beginning was the one that outsold. It just went mad and put us in the proper charts. And I did my Top of the Pops performances. And again, it was totally surreal being there and thinking, I'm at Top of the Pops. I'm going on Top of the Pops. So it was just lovely, fabulous.
But that version that you said that did well, would it be right in thinking that some versions did better in different countries?
Yes, quite possibly. Yes. I think in places like Brazil and the United States, they still liked the completely fast versions. Yeah. You know, they don't need it to start slowly. They wanted the fast. Although in the States, I think they did like the slow start, because I did a TV program over there, where I had to perform it, and it was the slow intro. So yeah, I mean, I did a gig just a few weeks ago and was requested beforehand by the guy that booked me to actually do that slow start version of Total Eclipse. And I had to listen to it because I hadn't sung it in so long, because I always do the 6-minute fast version. So it was quite weird doing that in a club. But it worked well. They seemed to enjoy it, so that's all good.
And the two like prevailing videos that are out there, like you say, the blue version and the yellow version. Am I right in thinking they were supposed to be blended into one at one
yes,
stage?
Yes, they were supposed to be, but in those days they got me a makeup and hair lady, and the hair in the two different videos was so different they couldn't blend them. So they ended up just people choose which one they go for. But the worst thing for me with the videos was that I got a message from Mike Stock the morning of filming just saying, you mustn't smile. Well, people know me as a very smiley person, so it was such hard work. So trying not to smile on one of them, I just ended up looking scared most of the time. I just sort of had these sort of quizzical eyes trying not to smile. I just looked like I was fearful. But we got there in the end somehow. Yeah.
Well, it was a smash hit a global smash hit, wasn't it? All over the world. Reached number 5 in the UK, number 1 in Australia, Japan, Brazil, Israel, Spain, Holland, Canada. Got to number 2 in the US and spent 6 months on the Billboard Hot 100 chart over there. And you spent a lot of time over there in the States, didn't you? What was that like?
That was amazing. It was just at the end of my slipped disc. So we flew over there. My osteopath was giving me osteopathy one day, and 3 days later I was having acupuncture, and this was going on for about 6 weeks. And she said, you know, if you want to get on that plane, then you need to have this done. So I got there, but the look on the record company executive's face when I arrived at the airport in a wheelchair was phenomenal, because I was due to do sort of, I think it was 6 weeks of touring the United States. So this female turns up in a wheelchair, and they, what must have gone through that guy's mind was, you know, no one could think. But I sort of dashed out of the wheelchair, and from then on just loved every second. I mean, we were having so little sleep. The geographical sort of element to the tour was off the scale. So I started in Buffalo, New York, and then flew to Vinton, Louisiana, and then up to somewhere else. And it was just mad. It was sort of right down south, right up north, over to the Midwest, over to the East, you know, just mad, but absolutely fabulous. And I would just catch a few hours on the flights. I would, you know, you didn't see much. You got to an airport, you'd then be driven to your airport hotel, you'd get your stuff ready for the gig, you'd be driven to the gig, you'd do the gig, get back to the hotel, have some food, go to sleep for a couple of hours, get up and get a red eye flight to the next place. So, and it would all start again. But it was so enjoyable. And then there were quite a few where we were doing shows with other artists. Corona, you know, this is the rhythm of the night. She was on it, her and her husband and their tour manager. And we had the biggest laugh on this cranky old tour bus that we were given. We were going all over the place and just having so much fun. And I got to know a lot of artists that way. And we just had great fun. It was lovely.
Yeah, I mean, so I mean, you mentioned Corona there. You know, you made a huge dance hit in the middle of the 1990s. I mean, I love 90s music, in particular 90s dance music. I think that was such a great time for dance music, with awesome tracks being released, especially in Europe, particularly coming out of Germany, Netherlands, Italy, the whole continent, really. And you were part of that. I mean, how did it feel to be part of that kind of incredible sort of movement at the time? Did it feel like something special at the time?
It was special because we were part of it. My stuff is very poppy dance. And, you know, I see some of the same artists now still doing things, but they're much more sort of heavy dance, if you like, you know, the sort of trancey stuff.
Yeah.
But we all sort of amalgamated, you know, and we do shows in the United States or Brazil or Canada or whatever. And, you know, because the audience was so huge, you'd have, you know, 40,000 people out in front of you. So they liked different aspects of the dance sort of styles. And it was just a lovely, lovely time. It was great fun. Working with the others was lovely. You know, that's the good thing. It's wonderful being booked for gigs where you're just the only person, but it's always more enjoyable when there's others on there with you, because you can watch them and you can cheer them on and they do the same with you. And it's a reason why I enjoy Pride events so much. You get there, you do 20, 30 minutes, whatever. But, you know, backstage, everybody's just getting on and having fun and cheering each other on. It's a bit like the Olympics is at the moment. Yeah. You know, it's just lovely. And seeing the States as much as we did was just wonderful. You know, I did really enjoy it, even though, as I say, you just saw airport hotels most of the time and then the venue, which was usually a baseball stadium or something like that, you know, because they were big, big shows. It's kind of unreal in a way to sort of look back and think I was part of that. You know, not many UK artists get to perform on these huge American stages. Also, while we were there, the record went from number 5 in the charts up to number 4 the week that we weren't expecting to go up. We did, you know, we expected to go down from number 5, and we went up to number 4, and Michael and Janet Jackson entered at number 5, so we were beating them. And wow. Then it carried on going up to number 2, so, you know, just a phenomenal time, really just amazing.
Yeah, and so you mentioned Brazil there. I mean, I've been listening to a lot of your music again ahead of this interview and watching your videos on YouTube, Nikki. I was scrolling through the comments and maybe half of them were in Portuguese. So, like clearly you made a huge impact over in Brazil.
I adore South America. Brazilians. I just get so excited when I'm booked for a few weeks over there now. I love going to Brazil. Obviously, at the moment, it's not even on the cards, but yeah. I absolutely love going over there. And, you know, when they're singing back to you, this was the first country I went to where, you know, I had a band behind me. And then the very first time, I still remember it, I went out on stage with one of the songs called Is There Anybody Out There, which is an original, and they were singing it back to me. Now, that's something, as a singer, you are not prepared for. Yeah, they were singing it in English, or COD English, yeah, back to me, and all the way through the show, they knew every Nicki French song from that first album, and there's one song that is the big, big, big one over there, which is Did You Ever Really Love Me, which I have gone on record many, many times as saying it's the best song I've ever recorded, my favourite song. And Brazil thinks so too. It's their favourite Nicki French number. And they just go mad. When the first few chords start, they just scream. And it's superstardom status over there. It's just lovely. I absolutely love being over there.
Yeah, I mean, if you were, obviously you can't because of COVID right now, but if you were to go to Brazil now, like what's your level of fame over there? Like,
I don't think it's as big as it was. I mean, you know, we're a generation on now, effectively, but there are still places that will book me. And yeah, high society weddings, quite a lot of the people now getting married grew up with my music. So they contact Gino, who is the band leader over there, and, you know, they sort of say, you know, is there a possibility? So I've done quite a few society weddings over there, which is amazing. It's just great. But there's something very, very, very special about Brazilian people, particularly in São Paulo, where I tend to be based. There's a strange gentleness about them. And it's something I've not seen anywhere else. And I absolutely love going over there. They introduced me as Nique French, not Nikki. It's Nique French. That's how they say it. But I just love going over there. I love doing the shows. It elevates my sort of self-confidence a bit, really. And it's just wonderful. I love going over there. It's such hard work. There was one time I did 6 shows in 36 hours, and these shows were an hour long with the band in different areas, you know, different states even, but we managed it. We managed to do 6 shows in 36 hours. I was so tired at the end of it, and oh, it was just great. I felt exhilarated because I'd done it. I'd got through them.
Wow, you know, that sounds exhausting though, but
it was.
your second single, For All We Know, reached number 42 in the UK charts. Well, that was a false position, wasn't it? Because there was a barcode error. So my understanding was when the single was being like put through checkouts at stores across the country, it was just being registered as like unidentified CD single, as opposed to Nikki French, For All We Know.
Exactly.
And as you say, it should have got to about 15, 14 in the charts.
Yeah, so, Millward Brown, the company that compiled the numbers, they admitted afterwards, apparently, that it should have been around number 15.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Going back to the last interview that I did, there was a kind of problem with one of Fix's singles, and there was a sort of like appeal board that they were able to go through to get their sort of chart position sort of upgraded again. Was there no sort of appeals process back then that
not really. As I say, Millward Brown were the guys that compiled the numbers from all the stores, and I do have in my files, I still have a fax that Mike Stock sent to someone at Millward Brown, which starts off with, I'm sorry for shouting at you. And then he goes on to say, you are jeopardizing a new singer's career here. They tried to claim that there was evidence of dodgy sales tactics, but there really weren't. You know, someone had gone in and bought 3 copies in a little independent record store. That's not dodgy sales tactics. That's buying a copy for your mum, your grandmother and yourself or something. There was no sort of appeals process, not really, apart from, as I say, this strongly worded fax to the company saying this is out of order. You know, you've effectively just stopped someone's career. And with the sort of thing I do, I just think it's happened. There's not a lot we can do. Just get on, you know. But it really did affect my status in the UK, to be honest. It really did. It never recovered from that, because your second single is almost more important than your first. A bit like your albums, you know. People always say the second album is so much more important because it's quite often a letdown. There was nothing that we could really do.
Yes, I mean, how did you sort of cope with that? Because, you know, just being the kind of victim of something that's sort of unfair and nothing to do with you, just a case of being philosophical, I guess. And
absolutely. And you know, it was still being played on the radio. It got dropped a fair bit after, you know, the 42 entry as opposed to the 15. If it had gone in at 15... or just within the 20, then it would have gone further up the radio airplay scale. But of course, it got dropped straight after. But I, you know, I still had gigs in the book, and I was starting to get the interest from the United States and Brazil and places like that. So in a way, at the beginning, we didn't really notice the knock-on effect until a year or so later. But it really did. It did hamper everything, you know, because it would have given me more of a standing. I could have started doing lots of shows with a live band in bigger venues, you know, because I would have sort of built my reputation more. But it was what it was. I was still working, and I've always said I'm a live singer. You know, I didn't want to mime things. I go out, I earn my money from singing in the, you know, at gigs that I've been booked for. And that didn't stop. So as far as I was concerned, I was just carrying on. You know, I'd never had record royalties before, so it wasn't something I was used to. So yeah, I just carried on doing the gigs as best I could.
And there was a bit more bad luck to come as well, wasn't there? Because this time over in the US, where your second single was "Did You Ever Really Love Me," your sort of favourite single, there was a kind of disagreement between the different US and UK record labels over promotion of the single. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, we were with Critique Records over in the US. And Love This Records here. And each thought that the other one was paying for the promotional sort of stuff. And so neither one did. So who loses? The artist.
Yeah. And more generally, sort of just in terms of promotion, in the mid-1990s, as a woman in your 30s, trying to sort of focus primarily on your voice and the music you were producing, as opposed to kind of image and sex appeal, like, did you sort of encounter any issues with kind of like PR people whose like job it is to sort of get your music out there and create a buzz around you?
Yeah, there was one that wanted me to have a made up stalker, because stalking was the big thing around that time. So They suggested that we invented a stalker, and I just said, no, just not my way. No, I don't lie. I don't do that. No. Yeah, and I was adamant I wanted to, you know, just do normal, proper promotion. I didn't realize at the time that, yes, you did need more of an image. You needed more of a sort of cutthroat way in, really. And in a way, I don't regret it. You know, I wasn't put on a strict diet or anything like that. So, you know, I've managed to get through by my voice, I guess, rather than any image or any sort of storyline behind me. And so I'm quite proud of that in a way. You know, I let my voice sort of do it. And yeah, maybe if I had gone down the sort of let's make up a story type route, might have sold more, might have more of a following, whatever. But I kind of, my conscience is clear that I just stuck to working hard, basically. Mm-hmm. And that was that.
So your debut album, Secrets, released in the summer of 1995, sold more than 50,000 copies in the US. But as you say, your second album, you know, like you say, often referred to as, you know, the difficult second album for everyone. 2 years later, in 1997, French Revolution. I'm interested in that, because you kind of wrote a fair bit of that album yourself, didn't you?
I co-wrote, yeah. I'm better at co-writing than writing straight off from scratch. Yeah, there were two producers who wrote sort of the bare bones of most of the songs. And so, you know, we kind of collaborated on it. And again, you know, I would work out the backing vocals and harmonies and with one of the guys, he wasn't much of a singer, so he would play me the backing track and try and sing me what he thought the tune should be, and I would think, I haven't a clue what you're singing, so I'd just do it myself, kind of thing. That album came about after I'd left Love This. It was, you know, there was no sort of nastiness. It was just, we couldn't really come to agreement on the terms of a new contract. And I'd got a new manager by then who was saying, look, you know, these guys want to record with you. We're ready to start doing some stuff. You need new material to take to Brazil. You know, why don't we give it a go? So that's how the new album came about. And it was more dancey. I guess in a way, subconsciously, we were gearing it towards the Brazils and those sort of markets. And yeah, you know, it went down very, very well. And I made more money from that album, I have to say. But the French Revolution album, I really enjoyed doing that. I did enjoy that.
Yeah, and it attracted the attention of a very big name, didn't it, back then? Jim Steinman, for those who aren't aware. Do you want to tell our listeners about who he is?
Yes, so Jim Steinman is the man behind all the well-known songs by Meatloaf and Bonnie Tyler. He wrote Total Eclipse of the Heart. He wrote Bat Out of Hell. He wrote so many. Sadly, passed away a few weeks ago. He had already contacted Love This Studios and had sent a message to me because he'd heard Total Eclipse of the Heart. And he just sent a message saying, congratulations and continued success. And then many years later, he contacted my then manager and wanted me to record with him. I never met him as such, but we spoke on the, like a down the line telephone, a bit like a Skype, but it was audio only.
Yeah.
So I went to Metropolis Studios in London and recorded a couple of tracks. And he sent me a very expensive bottle of wine, as a sort of welcome, thank you, etc. Because he was in the process of starting up his own record label called Ravenous Records. It was again quite surreal working for him, but wonderful, just a really great, different but great experience.
Yeah, just as we mentioned in Total Eclipse of the Heart again, I forgot to ask, but have you ever met Bonnie Tyler?
No, there was one chance where we were both booked for Cardiff Mardi Gras, their Pride event, and she suggested that we did a duet. Well, that would have gone mad over the internet. But a few days before the actual event, she then had to go over to Belgium or the Netherlands or something like that, where she's very, very popular, to do another show. So we never did actually meet, sadly.
Oh. Presumably she's a fan then, if she wanted to duet with you.
Well, I don't know, because in the early days of my version, I was told that she didn't like it. Yeah. But I've never found out, because we've never actually crossed paths as such. You know, it was lovely that she suggested that we did the duet. But it, as I say, it never sadly happened, so never mind. Maybe one day.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So 1999 comes around and you get another call from your old mate, Johnny Springate. So he had another song he wondered if you'd be interested in singing. It was called Don't Play That Song Again, and its writers were interested in entering it into Song for Europe.
He was so hesitant when he was phoning me and asking about it. Lots of ums and ahs and sort of saying, if someone had written a song that they wanted you to sing and they mentioned that it was for Eurovision. Would you be interested? And I was like, oh my God, yes! So, yeah, he didn't know that I was a huge fan of Eurovision. From a little girl, I was transfixed at Eurovision weekends. Yeah. So, yes, yeah. So I went over, recorded it, loved the title, but it's a very Marmite title. People either think it's the worst title in the world for a Eurovision song or the best title in the world. I loved it. I loved the tongue-in-cheek sort of aspect of it. And then a few years ago, actually, I did a show in a church in London with just a piano, a grand piano, and me. Someone else playing the piano. I'm not that good. And I did it as a ballad, and it worked so beautifully well, and it made people realize what a sad song it really is. But I digress. So yes, so I recorded it, John submitted it, and it went through a few stages, a few processes of shortlists, and then we were down to the final eight that were played on Radio 2, and we won that handsomely. I had the somewhere I have the voting figures, and we had pretty much double the second place song, and then ended up on a 4 o'clock stint in on a Sunday afternoon on BBC One.
So I mean, just before we get on to the actual song contest itself, I am curious to get your kind of thoughts on the process by which the UK picks its Eurovision entry, because we seem to kind of change the way we do this quite often, don't we?
And I
just watched, funnily, well, you know, this morning, I just watched that 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. it is out there. It's on YouTube, and I watched it this morning. We've had programs like it, haven't we? We've had you were on at sort of 4 p.m. on a Sunday. On a Sunday, which was a bit odd. We've had it like prime time Saturday night. I mean, what do you think is the kind of best way of kind of selecting the UK's Eurovision entry?
I think because there does seem, over the last few years, there does seem to be a rejuvenation in watching the final of Eurovision itself in this country. It's kind of become a cult thing. It's always been a cult thing, but it's kind of just become a little bit more popular again. I don't like BBC telling us this is your song, this is your singer. Mm-hmm. I don't like that at all. I think that the voting public need to be involved to keep their interest. I may be biased, but I loved, as a child, I loved having, we had things like the Cliff Richard show, or the Lulu show, or the Olivia Newton-John show, where there would be two songs each week or one song each week performed that was of six or eight finalists in Song for Europe. And then the final week, they'd all be sung. And the audience would get to vote on their favourite number. It used to be, in the early days, it was one sort of act that would perform all the songs. Then it became a competition within a competition, so there'd be different artists, like I did, different artists with different songs. And I like either of those. I don't mind either of those, but I do feel we need to have a choice. We need to have the public's interest and the public's involvement. Otherwise, you know, it just goes in and that's it. Having said that, I loved our song this year. I mean, bless his heart, James Newman did a fantastic job for us. I loved Embers. I think it's a great number. I'm just not a fan of the broadcaster saying, right, we've chosen the artist and here's their song. Yeah, that there's no excitement there. There's just no excitement. I don't think we'd ever get to the stage like Sweden, where it's their most watched program is Eurovision out of a year. Their second most watched program is Melody Festivalen, which is their process of choosing the artist. Yep. And it goes over weeks and weeks, and all their top artists enter time and time and time again. And it's the hugest honour to represent Sweden at Eurovision. You know, it's their biggest thing. They love Eurovision. I don't think we're at that stage, but I do think it would be nice to have a competition back again. Mm. I loved that.
Mm. So, you know, as a huge fan, as someone who's competed there, someone so steeped in Eurovision history, do you have any thoughts on why it is that we're struggling to get good results at the moment?
Not really. There's lots of reasons. You know, you'll have people saying, oh, well, nobody likes us, so we'll never get any points. That makes me yawn. There's another thread that, and I would go along with this, that the last few years, other countries spend a fortune on the staging of their performance. Mm. And we kind of let it, you know, we have two white great big polystyrene trumpets this year on the stage. It just didn't compute with all the graphics. I hate the ones where they're using a green screen and they've got all the graphics going, but it seems to work a lot of the time. I loved it when it was all about the song. Mm-hmm. You know, but there is a little thread of me that says, but you have to move with the times. I did like this year's show very much because, you know, in the face of adversity, they put on a fantastic show. And I think they came back a little bit from all the technological sort of stuff on stage. They brought it back a bit, so it was a bit more normal. You know, there are so many reasons. You know, a lot of people say, oh, the UK just doesn't think it needs to try. Maybe there's an element of that, but that's unfair on the performers because the performers try their hardest. It's a big, big deal to all the performers that go to Eurovision. You know, it's a huge honour to represent your country at anything. But there is a kind of snottiness sometimes with certain people that work for the setup. So who knows? Who knows? But you know, I still firmly believe we can win again. People always say, ah, we're never going to win. Nobody likes us. Nobody votes for us. And that has been statistically proven to be untrue. We get votes. We just, the way it's done now with the, you know, the 12 down to one and then the audience vote. I mean, I love that. The excitement of the two different votes, I think, is phenomenal. But, you know, with James this year getting 0 points, there were a couple of countries, I believe, that did place him 11th. So he would have got points if he'd just got a few more, you know, and you can always go along with that. But, you know, in the old days, people were saying Western Europe will never win it anymore, you know, because it's now over in Eastern Europe. And, you know, you've had the Balkans all sort of like split up. So they've each got their own votes, and Russia, Ukraine, all those will vote for each other. And it's not so much sort of partisanship, it's to do with they know that style of music. That's what they hear all the time on their radios. Mm-hmm. They know the artists. They're the top artists of those countries. They're on their TV screens constantly. Maybe if we had an England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, and then Ireland entries, then maybe we'd do better. You just don't know. But straight after saying, oh, you know, Western Europe will never win again, Germany won. But they did a huge promotional push with that, with Lena and Satellite. She went around all the different countries doing huge promotion for months beforehand. And it worked, you know. Mm. By the time it got to Eurovision, all the different people in the countries knew the song and voted for it because it was familiar. Maybe that's what we should do. When Jade Ewan was our representative, they put her on a bit of a promotional drive, and we ended up fifth. So, you know, it can happen.
So I know it's obviously it was a childhood dream of yours to represent your country at Eurovision. I know it's difficult, but if you can, are you able to just encapsulate what that week of your life was like in Stockholm in 2000?
Completely mad. It was just non-stop. Again, very little sleep. You every other day, because back then you only had a week of rehearsals, whereas now, because there's so many more countries entering, there's 2 weeks. You would be rehearsing every other day. You'd have about, I think you had about a half hour or 20 minute slot for your rehearsal. Then you went to the press room, or the viewing room first to see whether you were happy with the cameras. Then you went to the press center to do press conferences. The venue was within the hotel that all the artists were staying in. So you didn't have to go out of the hotel, but the fans were staying there as well. So you were always stopped by various fans wanting to interview you or pose for photos or have their program signed or whatever. Then you'd have a consultation with hair and makeup. And then, of course, Sweden wanted to show off Stockholm. So you'd be on these various tour buses going around the city, doing various things, having receptions with the mayor, just so many things. It was just phenomenally busy and just wonderful, absolutely wonderful. Then for 1 year, which was unusual for the UK, they held a UK delegation party, and we did get party of the week. Yay! Yeah. So we knew how to party, but it was just mad. It was just a mad whirlwind of a week. Just my feet did not touch the ground at all.
Wow. So last year marked the 20th anniversary of your Eurovision entry. Have you done anything to mark that milestone?
I got in touch with the singers that I'm still in contact with. There's one that I'm not in contact with anymore, but the other three, I got in touch with them and with John Springate and Kevin Bishop, who was our producer for the BBC at the time, executive producer. And the singers and I, we put together a version of Don't Play That Song Again, and we all filmed ourselves, and then my friend Hussein put it all together as a video to celebrate the 20 years because we couldn't get together because of COVID. So that was great fun, and it went down very well with the fans, I think. And then we all had a Skype or Zoom call the night of the 13th of May, which would have been the exact 20 years. We all got together on a Zoom call, and that was lovely, and just reminisced and all had our own little memories, and that was fabulous. And at some point soon, Vic, Patty, Joseph and I will get together in London like we've done before, and we'll have dinner and lots of drinks and just a big giggle. We'll just get together and have fun, and if John's over from Wales, he'll be invited as well. So yeah, we'll have a great time.
Would you ever consider recording that kind of slower version of Don't Play That Song Again?
It's not a bad idea, actually. Yeah, I've never thought of doing it, but it is a good idea to think of. Yeah. We've started now doing it's hopefully going to be a series of little mini albums or EPs called Let's Play That Song Again, which is me picking favourites from various years and recording them for the fans. Yeah, maybe for next year's. That's not a bad idea. Maybe. What's this space?
It is, like you say, it is absolutely fascinating, though, isn't it? The way some songs sound really upbeat and happy, but then when you do slow it down and you listen, actually focus on the lyrics, they can be heartbreaking, can't they?
Absolutely.
It's incredible what music can do, just how the subtle change can completely change the meaning of something.
Yeah.
So in more recent times, you've been doing quite a lot of acting, haven't you? And you were really kind of like motoring along with your theatre work before COVID hit, weren't you?
Yeah, sadly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were working on Menopause the Musical 2, Cruising Through Menopause, as it's known. I'd been connected with Menopause the Musical 1 for many, many years. I was in the first ever production in the UK, which was at the Shaw Theatre in London. I was an understudy for two of the four parts. So there were two understudies, each covering two roles. And then I was offered the understudy for all four parts in Ireland when they did a tour over there. And it was mad over in Ireland because they loved the humour. It's very soft, lovely, gentle, funny, old style humour. And then I did the UK tour and I went back to Ireland a few times. I actually played the role of Power Woman and of Housewife a couple of times over in Ireland. And then I sort of decided, right, I'm leaving it now. You know, I've had enough of working as an understudy. And then just sort of about a year two and a half years ago, was invited to audition for this new version called Menopause the Musical 2, and immediately got cast in the role of Power Woman. And we started rehearsals in Glasgow a year ago last January, and everything went so well, and we opened in Darlington, and we were there for 4 or 5 days. And it was just such a great show to be part of. Just so much fun. Much funnier than the first version. Just really good. And I was having an absolute ball with Rebecca Wheatley, who used to be on Casualty, and Cheryl Ferguson from EastEnders, and Nicole Barber-Lane from Hollyoaks, and me. And a lovely lady called Martine, who was our understudy and dance captain. We just had a ball. We were playing to, we were getting standing ovations at every single show. We had 100% record of standing ovations from the whole audience at every show. And our final show was in my hometown where I live, of High Wycombe, on the 15th of March last year. And then on the 16th, it all came to a stop. Yeah. And there's been a few times where the show was supposed to restart, that has had to be stopped and then start, you know, and then we were going to restart in the June, then it was going to be October, then it was going to be, November or something. And in the end, the producer just said, right, I'm writing off this year. We're going to go for 2022 and we're starting again. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we're starting again at the end of January, and starting shows in February and going through till July, August time, I think.
Excellent. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And how on earth, Nikki, did you manage playing 8 different parts in Annie?
They were all very, very small roles. They were like one scene, and then I'd be off and change the outfit, change the wig, this, that and the other. They were all very small roles, but it was great having the different ones. I think my favourite was Frances, can't even remember her surname, in the White House scene. I had more to say. I sang my own bit in one of the songs. That was my favourite. But it was a great show to be part of. It was busy, you know. As I say, I was changing clothes and wigs and God knows what every few minutes. But I enjoyed it, and being the understudy to Sue Pollard as well as Miss Hannigan was great. I loved doing the understudy calls because it was the only time I'd ever get to play the role. But yeah, I enjoyed that. It was grueling doing 9 months on tour, you know, just going from place to place, you know, and it was hard work, but it got me ready, you know. Mm. it sort of made me ready for tours. So yeah.
And so when lockdown did happen, like that, how did you kind of make use of the extra time provided?
I didn't really. I thought, okay, I'm not earning any money, so what's the cheapest thing I can do? Read books and watch TV rather than go out anywhere. So that's what I did. I just made the most of being at home. I grew my veggies, which I like to do anyway. That wasn't a new thing for me. But yeah, I grew some veg and went for lots of walks. And that was it. You know, I like to do baking as well. So I was baking a lot, but I had no one to give the baking to. So I was getting bigger and bigger. I was dropping off biscuits and cakes to various neighbours and friends. And that was it, you know, just we couldn't do anything for a while. I did manage last Christmas. I was lucky enough to be one of very, very few shows that went ahead at Christmas. And it was a variety show with Gareth Gates down in Barnstaple again. Yeah. And yeah, I was lucky enough to do that. It was scheduled for 10 days, two shows a day, and we managed 9 before everything came to a halt again. But that was great. That was great fun, but hard because when you're backstage at a show like a panto or something, you all give each other hugs. You go up to each other. You're going into each other's dressing rooms. We weren't allowed to do any of that. It was social distancing. Even on stage, they'd painted snowflakes on the stage so that we had our spots and we couldn't leave them. But it worked really well, and credit to the company that put it on, because, you know, it just worked and we had a great time. We did. We loved it.
And are there any plans for any new music coming up?
Yes, I did. Actually, that's the one thing I did do. Not during lockdown itself, but when the lockdown had been eased slightly before, I did get in the studio to start recording for a new album, which was supposed to be planned for, I think, autumn time, but it may get delayed a fair bit. We haven't finished all the songs yet. I've been back in the studio recently. I'm not sure how many there are left to record, but there's 2 or 3 more, I think. So yes, new album is on the way. Panto is on the way. Menopause the Musical 2 is back on, hopefully. So yeah, it should be okay. And I'm very lucky that my diary has gigs in for the next few weeks. I was so lucky. I thought it was just sort of 1 or 2, but actually the last few weeks I've been booked each weekend, which is lovely. I just hope I don't get pinged. I don't want to get pinged. Because if I did, then I have to take a test and then I have to maybe isolate. And yeah, I can't afford to, you know. I'm back on the earning trail again, which is lovely. But I'm being very careful. I live on my own anyway, and I'm always very careful. So yeah, hopefully I'll get through and we can get back to some sort of normality and not worry about the ping.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Well, it sounds like the future's really bright, Nikki, and you've got loads in the diary, and it's all.
Let's hope. Let's hope.
I mean, what can we expect from the new album? Is there a sort of direction that you're going in?
I like to do up-tempo songs. I like to do ballads. There's a mixture of both. There's a couple that we've said to one of the producers, can you just rejig this? Because it's, you know, there's a couple that are quite sort of medium tempo, and we want them a bit bouncier. But there's a whole mixture. There's a whole mixture. We always do a few covers, but then they're not usually really, really obvious covers.
Mm.
There's one I'd never heard of. And my agent, Matt, had said to me, you know, I think this would be a good song for you to do. And I was a bit reticent at first. And then I thought, oh, actually, yeah, maybe. So we did that. And then he came up with another one. And I thought, oh, I really like that one. So, yeah, there's some covers that a lot of people won't know are covers. But yeah, it's looking good. We're very happy. There's one that. When it comes out, I just hope and pray that people like it. It's an old favourite of many, many people's, certainly of mine. I actually got very, very emotional when I sang it in the studio. It's another marathon one. It's about 7.5 minutes long in its entirety. Again, I spent 2 or 3 recording sessions on the backing vocals because I wanted it to be huge. And I recorded the lead vocal and then thought, I'm not happy with this. So I phoned the record company and I said, would you please let me just go back in the studio to do the lead again? It's going to make a big difference. And they said, absolutely no problem. You do it. And it made a huge difference. And I'm very proud of it. So hopefully others will realize it's a tribute, not trying to compete. It's, yeah, cause it's a very big song, but I hope people like it.
Nikki, I'm curious. I'm intrigued. Well, I'll have to go out and buy that, and everybody else listening will just to find out. Well, hey, listen. The last time you were reticent about something, it turned out to be a super smash hit, didn't it? And the last time you covered an iconic song, it turned out to be a massive hit as well.
That's
so.
A nice way of looking at it. Yeah, I like that.
Well, thank you so much for agreeing to do this, Nikki. Well, I appreciate
so
it.
I represented my country. I can talk for it as well, as you've now discovered.
No, not at all. It's been amazing. And I apologize as well, because I know that I've kept you.
Not at all.
Longer than we said. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute joy.
I would encourage everyone to come and see you in Barnstaple, Cinderella.
Come down to Barney. Or around the country next year when we're doing Menopause the Musical again.
Oh, fantastic.
It's fun. It's great fun.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Nikki.
Take care.
So there you go. That was my interview with Nikki French, and I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed conducting it. I want to say a big thank you to Nikki once again for agreeing to the interview. She was really generous with her time and the answers she gave, and she was also just really warm and kind and put me at ease as the interviewer, because I'll level with you, I'm new to this podcasting lark and I'm new to interviewing people. So from my perspective, when an interviewee is as warm and friendly as Nikki was, it really does help, and hopefully that contributes to producing an interesting and fun and insightful interview. I thought some of the things we learned from the interview were really interesting. I had no idea, for example, Nikki was recovering from a slipped disc while recording Total Eclipse of the Heart and just before embarking on her massive tour of the United States. I really admire the way Nikki talked about responding to those unfortunate and unfair circumstances around her follow-up singles to Total Eclipse of the Heart. But if you're listening to this and you only know Nikki from Total Eclipse of the Heart and from Eurovision, I would urge you to check out some of those singles, such as Did You Ever Really Love Me and Is There Anybody Out There, because clearly they are adored to this day over in South America in countries like Brazil. It was fascinating to hear Nikki's thoughts on Eurovision and the process by which the UK selects its song and artist. I think what she said about countries sending their artists out on promotional tours and how that can have a significant effect on how successful their songs fare in the competition made a heck of a lot of sense to me, and is something we here in the UK should probably be thinking about if we want to start having more success in the contest than we have in recent years. As we heard there in the interview, Nikki always wanted to sing, but she also always wanted to act. And it's great that she's been getting to do that quite a bit recently. Certainly if you live near Barnstaple, it sounds like Cinderella, in which Nikki will be appearing this year from December the 10th, is going to be a lot of fun. And also Menopause the Musical 2, Cruising Through the Menopause, is touring across the country in 2022. So get your tickets for that as well. And it's great to hear Nikki's been working on new music, that a new album is imminent, and I'm really intrigued about what huge song she's covered that's going to be appearing on that album, certainly if it's half as good as Nikki's version of Total Eclipse of the Heart. I think we'll all be in for a huge treat. So if you enjoyed the interview, please mash that subscribe button so you won't miss any future episodes. If you haven't already, please go back and listen to the first episode where I interviewed Nick Major from Fix, who's releasing new music as a solo artist right now and whose career in music is currently showing on Trace Vault, my favourite TV channel, which is available on Sky Channel 360. I'm delighted to say our next episode features Amy Kearsley from the noughties girl group Clea. Amy's story is really interesting and compelling, and I can't wait to share my interview with her, with you guys, in our next episode. You can find us on Instagram at Mega Music Memories and on Twitter at Mega Memories. We are available on all the major platforms, so please hit that subscribe button to get all our new episodes. Stay tuned, and I'll see you back here for more Mega Music Memories.